Welcome to The Geek in Review, the podcast focused on innovative and creative ideas in the legal profession. I'm Marlene Gebauer.
And I'm Greg Lambert. So we are once again going to reach into our alumni list this week and pull out a former guest who was here with us about this time last year, I think. Mm-hmm. So Marlene, do you want to introduce who we pulled off our Rolodex this week?
Yeah, I would be happy to. We'd like to welcome Laura Leopard, founder and CEO of Leopard Solutions. Laura, we're really happy to have you back here on The Geek in Review.
Oh, thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
So Laura, I know every year you come out with some great surveys, and we talked about one last year with women retention in law firms and legal industry as a whole. And this year, we're going to touch on something that's probably in the same vein, but kind of on retention, but on the other end of things, and that is succession planning. And you have a great report that you put out. And, you know, Laura, based on that report, it seems like a lot of top law firms have partners who are nearing retirement age. And I imagine that, you know, this is our boomer generation that is finally getting to retirement age.
So wow.
Yeah, no.
Share your opinion there, Greg.
No animosity beyond from this Gen Xer here, I can tell you that. None at all. So in your report, you know, how are these firms planning for the future and making sure that, you know, there's a lot of talent that's about to walk out the door, and a lot of leadership that's about to walk out the door. So how are they planning for these partners to retire?
Well, from what we understand, they're really not planning at all. We got in touch with
stunned.
About yeah, everyone's shocked. Yeah, we contacted like 13 law firms and talked to people in different departments to ask them to cooperate with the white paper and come and be on the webinar. And they all said, succession planning? Yeah, we don't do that.
Yeah, how do you
or,
spell that?
We are terrible at that. So they all said no. And we really got the idea from talking to a number of consultants and stuff too, that this is really just something they are not focused on at all, which, you know, poses a problem for their long-term future. And recent events sort of prompted us to take a look at this to see what the real world toll is of not having a succession plan and not, you know, having older leadership step aside so younger ones can move in. And there really is a price that they pay for that.
I'm just curious, the previous generation, which I think is the silent generation.
Silent generation.
You know, we used to have very kind of almost draconian rules that people had to retire at 65. And, you know, there was, whether you liked it or not, there seemed to be.
And then it kind of crept to 70. Yeah. And, you know, and it's like creep.
Do you think that by pulling some of these rules away that, well, let me ask you this. Is it the boomers that are to blame, or is it the silent generation that's to blame for the lack of succession planning coming up now?
There's got to be somebody to blame.
There has to be someone to blame. Yeah. And it's
millennials.
It's probably. No, it's not millennials. It's the people at the top, it's the people running the show. And when those rules changed and there was no longer, you know, a forced retirement, they just kept going because they could. There was nothing really to stop them, you know, from continuing. And really no motivation to leave. It's not like they have a retirement plan in place. It's not like, you know, they will continue to get benefits from shares of the firm after they leave the firm and retire. There's really no incentive for them to step aside. As long as they stay at the firm, and as long as they keep all that wonderful origination credit, and as long it then that gravy train just kind of keeps rolling forward. But in many instances, it's to the detriment to the firm at large. So when you have a generation, or you've got leaders at the top that don't want to step aside, really for the good of the organism, for the good of the firm, then you're going to have a problem. They don't have an incentive to leave, and there is no parachute for them when they leave either. So if they haven't made enough money, they feel like they need to retire, that's one issue. But then I think there's also another issue that's rarely talked about, and that is the huge generational divide that we see today with millennials and Gen Z, and now other folks at the firm saying, you know what, I want a life now. I just don't want to be a partner at this firm. I want a life. When you've got people at the top that missed birthdays, missed weddings, you know, every weekend, working hours, if they leave today, what kind of life are they going to have? I think they have a hard time seeing what life will be without being this partner in the firm, without being this managing partner, right? They sacrificed a great deal to get to the top. And I do think they resent the fact that people now at the firm are not willing to make those same sacrifices. They're confused by that. And I think it really sort of shakes them to their foundation.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much, you know, who they are at work has become, that's the part of their psyche. And it would be hard to transition from that into, you know, a retirement phase. And as you said, like, you know, how can you even imagine what that would be? It would be so different. You know?
That's right. I mean, if you are spending the majority of your time and waking moments and efforts at work, that also means that you haven't had time to cultivate other interests outside of work. You know, you haven't built up a structure that you could, that would help ease your transition, you know, from that work life to a retirement situation. And I think that is another problem. I have a friend who has been working with not an Am Law firm, but a mid-sized firm where the managing partner is in his 80s and called, you know, she was there to help talk about succession planning because he realized he had to have someone take over the firm. And his big problem was no one wants to work today. They all want to see their kids. I didn't see my kids. You know, it's like,
how dare they?
I did this.
What's good for me is good for you.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And that kind of thinking is not going to cut it today. It's just not going to work anymore. It's worked for a long time, but it's not going to work for them in the same way moving forward.
And I might be getting ahead in terms of the questions, but it just struck me that firms aren't sort of helping with kind of these transition plans or helping attorneys with, you know, how to think about these types of transition plans and prepare them for it, that there's no help there to do that. It's just, you know, you're either here, you know, you're working or then suddenly you're not. And there's no sort of in between that I know of that sort of firms are sort of contributing towards.
Right. Well, that's because, I mean, if you think about it, you know, the law firms are so different from all kinds of other, you know, corporate structures, right? If you look at the accounting industry and you look at the big four, right, they've got all this figured out. They know how to deal with succession and they have, you know, a date and a time that these people have to exit and they have retirement plans and they have, you know, stock. They have all kinds of stuff that help ease that transition. In law firms, it's everything's on an individual basis. I have my book of business, and these are my goals. No one at the firm is thinking about the overarching problems of the firm, if they want that firm to continue, right? You know, there was a startling statistic that we mentioned in the webinar. It was like only 30% of law firms live beyond sort of that first generation. It's because they're not thinking for long-term life of that law firm because everything is sort of built on an individual basis, right? Mm-hmm. Your book of business, you're this, you're that. There is no retirement plan, even though I have heard of some firms that are starting like an annuity kind of program that would help continue to, you know, give these partners income after they have retired. That's something all law firms should be thinking about doing. Mm-hmm. As well as helping attorneys understand the importance of succession planning with their own practice, you know, how to bring people in, how to, you know, get the associates under you working with the clients that you have so they're familiar with them. So when you actually do exit, the firm is able to keep that business. There's so many things that firms could be helping these partners do that could smooth that path to succession, but they're just not doing it. They're not talking about it. They're not making a plan. So they are going to fall victim to those choices as either people leave or as younger partners and younger associates look at the firm and say, I'm not going there. What the firm requires, what the firm stands for is not what I want. And they will make decisions on that, and they're not going to continue to choose those firms. Or the best and the brightest may not continue to choose those firms. You know, we've seen a lot of people that have made statements that yeah, they're going to go work for big law, but their plan from the outset is only to be there for a couple of years. And then they can pay down their law school debt, and then they can go somewhere where they can really plan on having a life. Mm-hmm. Is that really great for big law? No, it's not. You know, when we reported on the women leaving in mid-career, which they are in huge numbers, we also saw that men are making that same choice. They're making that same choice, leaving in mid-career. You know, men have more opportunities in mid-career, so more people are being recruited and hired in mid-career, you know, for men. But they're also leaving in big numbers. All of that is a risk to the firm. And when we looked at those firms, we saw that they were top-heavy on the top for the older age groups. There were also, you know, younger people at the bottom and a pretty good number. And the slimmest portion of that pyramid were those mid-career attorneys. And that really should be much bigger because that's where a lot of that income is driven.
Yeah, the income, and that's where your next leadership is coming
that's
in.
That's right.
Exactly.
That's right. So all of that poses a risk. The question is, do they really care about that? Do they really care that this firm just continues? Do they really care about, you know, being able to recruit the best people from law school and having them stay at their firm over time? If they really care about that, then they're going to have to make some hard choices and start to think in a more long-term way.
Mm-hmm. So I think one of the challenges with having kind of, you know, a top-heavy partnership, older partnership, is the road to making partner is getting longer for everyone, whether, you know, they start as an associate, they come in laterally. And, you know, you've kind of hinted at this just now. It's like, do you think it makes it harder for associates, senior associates to, you know, to stay motivated and to stick it out? And is it shrinking the pool of new partners down the line?
Oh, I think absolutely it is. There's really a few factors that kind of, you know, affect this. But it was startling to us when we looked over time to see how long it took people to make partner, right, from an associate. In 2012, for entry-level hires, it took 1,353 days on average for them to make partner at their firm. Today, for entry-level hires, that number is 3,229 days. That's enormous. Every year, it's growing at a rapid rate. For laterals, in 2012, on average, 965 days. Today, it takes 1,622 days. So the time it takes to make partner has increased over time in a huge degree. But something else has really changed. Our friend Bruce McEwen over at Adam Smith Esquire wrote an amazing paper about the rise in non-equity partners. And he did say, I think there's at least seven firms now where there are more non-equity partners than there are equity partners. And that number has risen to a great degree, and it's going to continue to rise. What this tells me is that those equity partners are gaming the system. you know, if you're a non-equity partner, you're basically a senior associate with a title. It's like how everybody used to hand out the title of vice president to somebody, right? It's like, put it on the door. Don't give them a raise. Give them a new title.
Yeah.
Well, that's what they did to this group of non-equity, you know, partners. And by doing that, the other thing that they do is make sure that their PPP stays nice and high, right? Yeah. So while they're increasing the number of partners at the firm, they are holding fast to that small group of equity partners so they can inflate their profits per partner numbers. What does this say to the people that go to work for these firms? Wow. It's sort of like a shell game, right? You want me to come in. You want me to make money for the firm. You tell me that you want me to succeed and stay here and make partner, yet you make it harder to reach those goals every year. Not only that, but the number of billable hours required has also exploded since 2012. And as salaries have risen, of course, so has those billable hour requirements. So they really have set themselves up for failure.
Yeah.
Who's going to take that bargain? When they became partners, the guys at the top, the rules were different. It was easier to make partner low so many years ago than it is now. They have made it longer. They have made it harder. They have made the requirements much, much more difficult in order to stay and make partner.
Yeah.
Well, after COVID, you've got an awakening of people that say, I don't need this. Why do I need this? I you know, during COVID, I got to put my kids to bed at night. During COVID, I got to actually see my wife. I'm not going to give that up. There's a struggle. But for leadership to convince these kids to stay, and not even kids, but even those in mid-career to stay and get that partnership ring, is going to get harder and harder for them to convince them that this is what they want.
Well, if they see the system as game, they figure out how they can game the system, you know, and to their benefit.
That's right. As well they should. These are their lives. And frankly, if the firm is really just all about enriching those people at the top, who's going to buy into that?
Yeah.
Who's going to buy into that? If they structured it more like a normal company where they had an exit plan, they had a retirement plan, they had a profit sharing plan, they had, you know, something like that, that really made everybody feel like they all had a stake in the firm and in the game, I think more decisions would be made that were beneficial to the firm as a whole instead of just those people at the top.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And just a point of clarification, when you talked about the number of days that it took for an entry-level attorney to make partner, is that mm-hmm. to make non-equity partner or to make equity partner?
Well, that we could not distinguish over that time period. So now is title partner.
Yeah, my guess is that's, for most firms, that's non-equity, because most have that three, you know, the three-step career path,
right.
You know, of associate non-equity partner, then maybe equity partner. And I think Bruce is underestimating the number of firms that had this model.
That right.
Well, and we kind of talked.
We'll check with him. Everyone should get that paper. It's a really great paper.
Yeah, it's a great paper. So we touched on this a little bit where we were talking about people that are really in their 40s, that are mid-career, are just leaving law firms. Now, I think we again, have touched on why this is, but what do you think firms could be doing to better retain that group of senior millennials, you know, younger Gen Xers that are in that sweet spot that we really need to have?
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's everything that they don't want to do. That's the bad news. In order to keep those people, they're gonna have to do a lot of things they don't like. And that's really, you know, sort of looking at everything, you know, from the top down. In our white paper, there was an anecdote about a post that went viral on LinkedIn from somebody who was a partner in big law. And he decided, I'm stepping off the hamster wheel. I want a life. I want to see my family. I turned down offers. I'm just done, right? This has to do with, you know, forcing everybody back into the office 5 days a week. It has to do with billable hours, that awful billable hour number that goes up every year. All of those things, the law firms tell us, are, that will never change. It's impossible. It will never change. Well, I got news for them. Unless they start considering that, there's going to be a whole new crop of competitors. We see all the time new virtual law firms cropping up. They are taking these people that are leaving big law. They are taking those people and they are letting them work whatever hours they want. They're letting them work from home. They have so much more freedom. And if they want to work a lot, they can work a lot. If they don't or they can't, they don't have to. You know, luckily, there are firms out there that have learned some lessons and are making some different choices. You know, in our, you know, one of our women white papers, we talk about several firms that have flex time where they've made partners, probably non-equity, you know, partnership, but they've done that on flex time where they're really working on a part-time basis. And one of the quotes I remember from that is an attorney's boss said to her, "I would rather have you 50% of the time than most of the associates out there 100% of the time." It's about retaining good talent and making accommodations to keep them. You know, there was a time when firms did not operate under the billable hour. There were multiple ways that they had fee arrangements and fee agreements. It's a rather recent invention, this whole billable hour thing, and it's really gotten out of control. Here's another little nugget for these firms. Churn is very costly.
Yes.
You know, these firms lose tens of millions of dollars a year in employee churn.
Yeah.
Because replacing people, I'm not talking about recruiting fees. I'm talking about all the other fees. I'm talking about the training and the onboarding and the time that it takes them to get ramped up into really being, you know, a fee earner for the firm. All the money that they have lost from all the people that have walked out the door. So if they looked at it from a holistic business sense, and they looked at all the cost of losing valuable, talented people, they looked at the cost of churn, and they also looked at customers trying to make a decision. So here's my choice. I need to pick a law firm to work with. Am I going to go with this 82-year-old attorney who may or may not be there in the next few years? They could retire. Then I'm going to be working with who knows who. You know, there are questions that clients make because they worry about succession. If I choose you as my law firm, I expect to work with you for the next 10 years. Who is really going to be working my case? Will it be you or will it be, you know, someone else? There's so many business problems that come up from the way that they're currently doing business. Yeah, there's people at the top making a lot of money right now. Yes, there are. And they want to continue that gravy train. But is that in the best interest of the firm as a whole? That's the question that they really have to ask.
Yeah. And I know on the virtual firms, I know we have at least one virtual firm that's in the Am Law 200, and that's Fisher mm-hmm. Broyles. And a new up-and-comer is Scale, which I just saw in the news this week, which merged with the boutique here in Texas. Those are real. And I think, you know, that they have a great opportunity. We'll probably see more of those.
You definitely will. You definitely.
Especially as they start asking people to come into the office 4 or 5 days a week.
So. Mm-hmm. That's right. Now, you know, we should watch and report on all of this, because as these virtual firms start creeping up into the, you know, top 200 ranks, that should really make everyone stop and consider what the next 5 to 10 years are going to look like. Here's the thing. The world is changing so quickly right now. The foot is down on the gas pedal. And no one knows where exactly we're all going. We've got AI out there. We've got AI going to be helping them in their work. There's multiple changes in almost every field. And then you've got the law, which is sitting on an island.
Then you've got big law.
That's right. Well, they can't stay there forever and survive, right? They're going to have to adapt and change because the world is rapidly changing around them.
Right, Right. Looking at the ages of most managing partners, I mean, many seem to be on the more, let's shall we say, experienced side. You know, and there could be a benefit to that. You know, do you think having sort of longer tenured leadership is better for law firms? Or is fresher thinking needed too? You know, should there be more of a mix? Should there be sort of regular turnover? Should there be mentorships?
Boy, I think there should be all of that. I think there should be regular turnover. I think there absolutely needs to be mentorships. We have to look at the, you know, origination credit system and how they do that. That definitely has to change. It's really, you know, we talk about age. I don't want to get into ageism. It's really about a state of mind. You know, if they are 56 and closed-minded, they're just as much a danger as if they're 85 and closed-minded, right? The one problem I think that the leadership that's on the older side at a lot of these firms, it's a recruitment problem. It's a recruitment problem. Because I think people tend to believe they are going to be closed-minded at the top. And if we see those same firms bringing people in 5 days a week and there's no flex time and there's no this and there's no that, their diversity numbers are terrible. There's all kinds of things that combine to make people look at that firm and go, I'm not going to join. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go there. You know, we sort of broke it down. We looked at the lateral partner success by looking at the ROI, you know, on partners that they brought in. And it was really interesting. We looked at the top 200, and the top 200 is not created equal, right? There's from the number one spot to the 200 spot, or really it's like 178 now because there's not that many left. We saw a big disparity. Yeah. And in the top 50, there was a huge difference in ROI between the firms that had younger partnership to the very old. The youngest band of partnership in that top 50 for lateral partner success, their success rate was 87%. Now, that same group of firms that had the oldest band of managing partners was a 72% success score. That's a big divide. That is a big, big divide. So when people are trying to make a decision about where to go, you know, they're going to look at a number of factors. But older leadership, for good or bad, has some connotations that go with it. You know, they're not a progressive firm. They're not forward thinking. I would much rather, you know, go to this firm because they seem to be, you know, more progressive, right? People also have to make room for other people. If you want to go to a firm where the majority of partnership are way beyond retirement age, as a mid-career partner, is that going to be a good choice for you? Or you feel you're going to be battling them for what you're looking for? Or for them just to make room for you, you know, to be in their firm? There's a lot of questions around that. But when we looked at that ROI, it was really clear who was doing better in retaining that partner talent. And it was the firms that had that younger group of managing partners.
Mm-hmm. You know, as we're talking, it reminds me a lot of it almost runs parallel to our political system and how we're seeing a lot of leadership. You know, we have a broad range of ages that are in politics, but most of the leadership that we see, especially in our federal government, are in their 70s and 80s. And one of the reasons that this happens is, you know, there aren't any term limits, and it's very hard to vote out somebody that's in office. So taking that situation and looking at how law firms are, now we talked about before that we had mandatory retirement ages. We also had term limits on leadership, that leadership was seen as cyclical, that you spent 3, 6 years, 8 years, and then you went back to work or retired. But now it seems like the leaders of law firms tend to almost have some type of tenure in that it's almost impossible to get them out. Do you think maybe we need to bring back term limits on how long you can be in leadership? And then, but does that also bring its own problems with it?
Well, it might, because if you have someone that's doing a tremendous job, you know, you want to keep them in that job, right? Yeah. So term limits, you could make them a bit longer. You could make them like, instead of 3 years, make it like a 10-year term limit. You can't go beyond this. Something like that might work. But I really do think they have to start looking at a retirement ages again. And it doesn't have to be 65. You know, you can take it up to 70, 71. Beyond that, just take a minute and reflect what's going on in our country today, right? Everyone is in despair that everyone running for the two front runners running for the highest office in the land are, you know, in their 80s. And the country has reacted to that by being very depressed by that prospect, right? So imagine, you know, what attorneys or young attorneys that are looking at this firm and looking to join it, how they feel about it. I mean, I don't think they can deny that is a problem.
Yeah. I always like the people that are 5 years away from retirement for 15 years. So,
yeah. In a couple years. Yeah. A couple years.
Yeah. Well, it can be hard to let go. And I think that's important for firms to look at that. How can they ease the exit? How can they do some sort of restructuring so they continue to have some income after they leave the firm? If they really look at it that way, I don't think you would have the problems that you have today.
Yeah.
You know, especially if you do have some sort of term limit for ages, right, where they have to retire, people can really start thinking and planning for what to do, you know, after they have to leave their firm. Then they might start looking at cultivating things outside of work, because I think that's really important to helping their exit, is to show them that there is life after leaving the firm and not just becoming an op counsel.
Right.
You know, really, really retiring and going on to do something else, having another challenge in their life, something else to do. And firms can help with all of that. But all of that takes thoughtfulness and planning and the will to do it. And right now, they don't have any of those.
All right. Well, you've set up my next question perfectly. So thank you for that. So what are some examples or case studies of law firms that you think have done succession planning really well? What can other firms learn from that? Or how could they institute it?
In our webinar, somebody asked Bruce McEwen that same question. And he was silent for about 5 seconds. And then he came back and he goes, I have no examples for you. I have no examples of a firm that really did succession planning well. I think, you know, he goes, I can tell you where it happened by accident that the succession planning worked. Mm. He goes, but I really don't know of any examples where a thoughtful, written, you know, real plan was successful, because they just haven't done it.
Now we're in depression mode again.
Well, it doesn't mean they can't do it. They just have to commit to doing it, and they have to recognize the problem.
And it's a hard conversation, I imagine, because the people who are making these determinations are the people that's going to impact. And so it's like, I imagine it's very personal. And that's a hard thing to do.
Yeah. It is. As Bruce called it, it is the third rail for law firms. You just don't touch it, because people can get hurt and offended and, you know, irate. So it's a tough subject to broach. It could ruffle many, many feathers. But looking at it from a business perspective, it makes complete sense to do it. And if they could take the personalities and take the, you know, personal feelings out of it and just look at it as a strictly business proposal, I think it could help convince people that it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, but it's hard for people in power to give up power.
So. Oh, it is. Oh, it is. Yes, it is. You know, look at George Washington, who was hailed as a hero because he had the courage to turn down a third term. Right. And the courage to say, no, I don't want to be your king. So it does take courage to make these decisions. It takes courage and it takes, you know, a real commitment to the firm itself to make these decisions. And these leaders at the top can do it. They can do it. They just, they have to want to. They have to want to. But it will take courage in order to make this change. But if they don't make it, they're really in danger of the firm falling from its lofty post, or even, you know, just crumbling and falling apart. Let's remember, like, as I mentioned in the white paper, I really started looking at this after we saw a big profile exit out of a top 200 firm. And it was because it was over 100 attorneys, right, that left the firm. And it was because they disagreed with the people at the top, according, you know, to reports. Who can withstand that, right? Yeah. What firms can lose 25% of their income as they walk out the door and survive and still be as, you know, vital as they were before? Believe me, there's not many. And they're in danger of defections like that if they continue to be unwilling to change and unwilling to bend. So there's a danger in doing something, and there's a big danger in doing nothing.
Yeah. So let's say hypothetically there's a George Washington managing partner at an Am Law 100 firm that reaches out to you and says, "Hey, we're really struggling with this. Is there like one piece of advice that you would give this person, this brave person that's saying, yes, we need to change, but we don't know how?" What do you think would be one of the most important things that they would need to focus on?
Well, I think they have to have the willingness to put everything on the table. Everything. Just as an exercise. Everything is on the table for change. And when I say everything, I mean everything. And they really should bring in someone from outside. They should bring in, you know, a law firm consultant and have them go over all of those things, what they could change in order to make their firm stronger, more resilient, and more attractive to the new people that they're trying to recruit and for those mid-level people that they're trying to retain. I hear all the time, you know, I was in a conversation with a law firm last week where, and it was kind of funny to me because they said, "Yeah, you know what we've noticed? We have noticed that women are all leaving mid-career." I'm like, yeah. Duh. Yeah. I got two white papers I can give you that can give you all of those numbers, and I'll tell you why, and I'll tell you how you can fix it. So everything should be on the table. If you really want to solve this problem, you have to look at everything objectively. You should bring in fresh outside eyes that can help you weigh the pros and cons of making a change here or there. But if you really want to be that remarkable leader that makes changes, that assures this firm's longevity over, you know, for another 100 years, then this is what you have to do. And this is the time to do it, because we are at an inflection point. I really do believe that. Mm-hmm. The pandemic changed a lot. You have seen law firms change a lot over time. The world around us, however, is changing at an even more rapid rate. And if they are not willing to look at what's ahead, look at their current problems, see what they did in the past that helped bring these problems right up and center, you know, for today, then they're going to, their success is going to be limited in the future.
Okay, Laura, so you know the drill. We ask all of our guests our crystal ball question at the end of the interview. And so I have to point out, about a year ago, we asked you the same question. You know, I wanted to mention one thing that you said that I think is relevant to this discussion. You said that younger generations like Gen Z and millennials are also questioning if law firm partnership is worth it, given the work-life balance sacrifices required. You know, the partnership bargain is becoming a bad deal. So how do you think this may add to the succession issues in the future?
Well, you know, for one thing, it's going to be a short term, it's going to be a real recruitment problem for them. If everyone is looking at these big law firms as a short term step, you know, that's going to be a big problem, right? Here's the even worse problem. And it's gone beyond just millennials and Gen Z, because now you see it going into different generations. The pandemic really changed the mindset for a lot of folks. I was at an art conference on a panel with a partner at a, you know, big law firm. He was in his 50s. And he said, he goes, yep, I'm never going back into the office again. I got a dog in the pandemic and I'm not going to leave my dog. Now, this is a 50-year-old partner that made this statement, right? And you see examples all the time of partners leaving because partnership is not what they expected. Partnership did not make anything easier. It wasn't the brass ring that they thought it was going to be. It was more work and more responsibility and less time at home. And they don't want it anymore. So it's not just millennials and Gen Z. It is now creeping up among mid-level folks and into partnership. So a lot of their minds have changed. You know, I also, there were a rather revolt at a firm recently. The partnership voted against ending remote work, but the managing partner pushed it through and they're going to bring them back, you know, 5 days a week. There's a revolt that's going to happen. It's not going to be a generational barrier. It's going to be throughout the firm. It's creeping. It's growing.
So it's actually becoming more pervasive.
It is. It is. And a bigger problem than it was even last year, 2 years ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like you nailed that one a year ago. So I'm going to cue you up again for this year. So what do you think are going to be some of the big...
She gets two crystal ball questions.
You do. That's nice. So, but what do you think are going to be some of the big challenges or changes over the next 2 to 5 years now?
Well, I think the rise of the virtual firm is really going to shake the industry quite a bit.
Are we seeing the beginning of the end of big law?
Well, you know, it's been said many times, yeah, right, throughout the years, you know, and they have been threatened with extinction time after time. But big law overall may change. You know why? Because the players in big law change. So you have some at the top, right, that have been at the top for a very long time. And then you've had other people join that group over the years. And now, as we just said, we've got a new virtual firm in that top 200 group. We're going to see more of that. And if the really great talent is going somewhere else, then I think you're going to see a shakeup in what big law is, right? If your only measuring stick is money, is income to make that group, then you're going to see a lot of virtual firms in that group. So I think that group will change. You know, we have our own ranking system because we believe that firms should be ranked on more than just their financial bottom line. There's a lot of different ways to measure a law firm. Our group of top firms are very different from the Am Law top 200 groups. And these firms are very interesting to watch. And there are going to be a lot of upstarts that shake up, you know, big law. And big law is going to have to make some changes in order to keep up with it. Pocketbooks are tight. People have become accustomed to paying, you know, you're paying $1,500 an hour for an attorney, right? This billable hour thing, I think, is also going to end up being a threat because some of these new law firms are giving clients what they want. They're not billing that way anymore. They're offering them alternative fee agreements. They're trying to make the client happy. And, you know, they're taking business away from big law. There should be some sort of openness to, you know, alternative fee arrangements, at least, you know, for some clients and in some instances. But these little virtual firms that are clipping at their heels right now, they're going to become even stronger over the next few years.
Right. They're starting from the ground floor in terms of how they're doing pricing and evaluating the value, whereas
right,
these large firms have to kind of turn the Titanic and change everything that they've built up, which is a big ask.
That's right. And when you are giving the customer what he wants, you're going to get a lot of customers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly right.
Well, one last question, the post crystal ball question. Do you think the industry has a too big to fail problem, that they think despite what I'm going to do, everything's going to continue on, you know,
because we're
a $4 billion law firm. What can I possibly do to undermine that? It just feels like that's kind of the attitude that I'm seeing from a lot of large firms.
Nothing's going to happen until I leave, and then it won't matter because I'll be gone.
Doesn't matter how hot this summer is. I'll be dead soon, so it won't be my problem. Right.
Well, I think they think they're too big to fail, but I don't know that anyone's too big to fail. And let's think about it this way. Their capital is people. It's all people. People make them money, right? It's not like they are selling, you know, boxes of widgets and they can sit on inventory and they've got that, you know, in the bank. People make them money. People make them money. What if they can't get those people? What if they can't get those people that can command that, you know, $1,500 an hour, billable hour, that's being the, you know, churn that's making them all that money? So if they are suffering from retention problems now and they're suffering from recruitment problems, they are not too big to fail. We have seen law firms go under for these very reasons. A group of 40 attorneys leave here and the firm just continues to go down over time and then it's just gone. Anyone can fail if you are making terrible business decisions. It could take a $4 billion law firm a long time to do it. But it's like a drip campaign. We see it all the time. Once those exits really start, they escalate and they escalate. And the more exits that you see, the more exits come right behind them. So what they do today really matters. And keeping their people happy really matters because those people are what they're selling. The talent of those people is that's what they sell. And if they can't keep their talent, then no, they're not too big to fail. I know they may think they are, but I don't think that's true.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation, as always. Laura Leppard, founder of CEO of Leppard Solutions, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much. I had a great time.
Yeah, me too.
And of course, thanks to all of you, our listeners, for taking the time to listen to the Geek in Review podcast. If you enjoy the show, share it with a colleague. We'd love to hear from you, so reach out to us on social media. I can be found at GabeBauerM on Twitter.
And
LinkedIn.
And I can be reached at Glambert on X and Glambert Pod on Threads and LinkedIn, of course. So, Laura, how about you? Is there, if someone wants to continue the conversation or learn more, where can they find you online?
Oh, they can find me at leopardsolutions.com. I'm also on LinkedIn. I don't do X.
you know, in the 90s, that had a completely different meaning.
Right. Yeah, I don't do that. But you can find me at leopardsolutions.com.
And listeners, you can also leave us a voicemail on our Geek and Review hotline at 713-487-7821. And as always, the music you hear is from Jerry David DeSica. Thank you, Jerry.
Thanks, Jerry. All right, Marlene, I will talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Devil's backbone ball at the devil's backbone.